to episode 2 of Marvelous, a podcast where I, Tom Lorre, and my sister,
Leona Lorre,
are rewatching all of the theatrical Marvel movies. And this week, we are talking about 20th Century Fox's X-Men, directed by Bryan Singer and written by David Hayter and like 50 other people. So, would you like to start off by learning a little history about X-Men in the comics?
Oh, yeah, I would like to. I have questions, too, but maybe you'll answer them. Oh,
okay. You want to start with your questions?
No. Go ahead.
Because, I don't think I have a ton of history stuff here, other than that they started in 1963, as with a lot of things, and the X stands for extra, because they have extra powers.
Oh.
Everyone assumes it's because of either
Xavier
or the X gene, which is what they call the gene that turns people into mutants. But no, Stan Lee says it's because extra.
The early 60s were a simpler time.
Yeah, well, I think he was ahead of the time using X as shorthand for extra. I mean, it wouldn't be until the 90s until extreme became thing.
Extreme!
Right. Jack Kirby, the guy who co-wrote a lot of, or really wrote a lot of the early Marvel stuff, he came up with Professor X and the idea for setting it in a school to normalize these characters, like treat them as normal people sort of thing. And the original roster was Cyclops, Marvel Girl, Beast, Angel, and Iceman.
Hmm.
What were your questions?
Oh, boy, you didn't answer any of them. Okay, so the cast for this movie, over in Team X-Man, we've got Charles Xavier, a.k.a. Jean-Luc Picard, the actor who plays him. Then they, like,
Sir Jean-Luc Picard.
Sorry. In their crew over there to the school, they have Halle Berry Storm, and we established immediately before she becomes Halle Berry Bond Girl. And then they've got Famke Janssen as Jean Grey. They've got, what's his real name? Cyclops.
Is it James?
James Marsden. And is there a fourth one? No, Logan becomes the fourth one. So Wolverine joins them.
And Rogue.
And Rogue joins. And then we meet a handful of other students very casually, but they don't give them names. Over on Team Bad Guy, we've got
the
Magneto.
The Brotherhood of Mutants.
Okay, over on the Brotherhood of Mutants, we've got Magneto leading Rebecca Romijn's Mystique, Sabretooth, Toad, and that's it, right, for that team?
Yes.
So my question is, are Sabretooth and Toad important X-Men? I had completely forgotten about them.
They, in this super, no. In X-Men in general, kinda. Like, Toad is an original member of the Brotherhood of Mutants going all the way back. And Sabretooth, in most depictions that I know of, is Wolverine's half-brother. And, like, even in the now non-canonical X-Men Origins Wolverine, he is played by Liev Schreiber. And it's, like, about their clashing throughout human history. But,
I prefer Liev Schreiber to this,
We'll see if you feel that way when we get there.
Okay.
I mean, not that he's awful, but the move, everything.
This heavy metal looking dude with power eyebrows, fangs, and a lion's roar, literally.
Uh-huh.
Like somebody recorded a lion and then played it.
He definitely sounded like a Wookiee, which
mouth.
I know Wookiee roars are like a combination of animal noises. But yeah, and I felt bad for him for having those blacked out eye contacts in my research. Like the contacts were something that came up where a lot of the characters were supposed to wear colored contacts, like Rebecca Romijn has them. Storm was supposed to have them, Sabretooth has them, but they were so awful that pretty much, I think Sabretooth might have, I think he might have been the only one who wound up using them consistently, and after leaving them in for too long, that guy was blinded for a day because they were so bad for your eye, Halle Berry hated them so much that after the first time she wore hers, she demanded that all of her eye effects be done with CG, because she was not going to wear those fucking contacts again.
No, gotta protect the assets.
Yeah, these, I mean, it sounds like a super horrible cost for such a minor effect.
Well, I believe they've gone all the way out of vogue because of the mounting evidence that those effects contacts leave some pretty significant damage in their wake.
Wouldn't surprise me. Did you have any other questions?
I guess my question was, because you're better than I am at canon, did the selection of characters make sense to you for what was the establishing movie in the franchise?
No, well, not really, sort of, but this is also something that came up in my scads of research, was that they didn't want to spend a lot of money, so they cut all the characters that would have been heavy on effects, like Iceman. You see him doing, you know, the little ice rose at one point. Like, he's a student, he's there, but he's not one of the core cast because he would require too much special effects, I guess. And Beast, who shows up in the later movies, also big effects character. I don't know if they ever planned on doing Angel, but basically, yeah, anyone who would have required too much special effects either was cut entirely or had their role reduced to minor cameos or, like, have their storylines heaped onto another character. Like, Rogue, she's totally not like the movie Rogue in any of the other representations, like, in the comics and the cartoon. Like, the cartoon, this takes most of its inspiration from the cartoon because that's what Bryan Singer saw. Like, when he was approached to do this, he was like, no, comics are a low art form, they're stupid. And then
children's cartoons, like, yes. On the other hand.
Well, that was the thing. Someone was like, hey, man, you gotta read these comics. So then he read a couple comics, and he was like, oh, this, I relate to this as a gay man because it's about persecution. So then to study up, he watched a bunch of the cartoon, because the whole process of making this movie started in the early 90s. I think, like, 93 is when they started floating this. They actually started trying to get this made in the late 80s.
Mm.
In 1989 through 1990, they were trying, it was Coralco was trying to make it, or Carolco, with Catherine Bigelow directing, and then-husband Jim Cameron producing, with Bob Hoskins as Wolverine.
Whoa, that would have been different.
Angela Bassett as Storm. And obviously, we did not get that because Carolco went out of business.
Because so late 80s, so would that have been like Bob Hoskins would have done this immediately after Roger Rabbit, instead of?
This would have been like the middle ground between Who Framed Roger Rabbit and the Super Mario Brothers movie.
Aye, aye, aye. Oh my gosh. Well, he was a good sport, Bob Hoskins.
He was great in Hook. Rest in peace. So then in, like, 1994 is when Fox got the rights to make a X-Men movie, and that's when they hammered out the basic plot of this then, pretty much, that...
Was Bryan Singer attached at that point?
He signed on in 1996, and,
Whoa.
Yeah, so took 4 years of concerted effort to actually get this movie made, and there's so many writers credited. David Hayter, who video game fans might recognize as the original voice of Solid Snake in the Metal Gear Solid series.
Oh, I was going to ask if that's
I know
who he
you're
was.
A huge Metal Gear fan. He is the credited screenwriter because his draft was the last one and the story supposedly most represents what he turned in.
Is he related to Bill Hader? Because I know who Bill
probably.
Hader
They're
is.
They're probably brothers.
They probably are.
I think that's true.
I'm going to ask the internet while you're going on with whatever you were going to say next.
I don't know. I mean, I have a bunch of notes. It's a bunch of trivia and whatnot. You want to just, it's mostly about who was cast when and how much Bryan Singer seems like a jerk off.
Well, I did have another question. This might be a good segue for that.
Shoot.
I remember that you don't like Bryan Singer. Why is that?
I don't know if that's ever come up. Are you just saying that now because I just said Bryan Singer seems like a jerk off and you...
I am 100% sure that you have dissed Bryan Singer to me before.
Maybe only in the context of, like, guys who are accused of sexual abuse but still get to keep working in Hollywood.
That
because
is
there
why
was
you
that
dissed
suit
him.
A couple years ago. Yeah, it's gross. He sure gets to make a lot of big budget movies in spite of such allegations.
Oh, I know why. Because he's still affiliated with the X-Men franchise. And so when we saw the most recent one,
Apocalypse,
where Sansa Stark does flying around, I think, mm-hmm. you were saying a number of things about Bryan Singer.
Aside from that, he also seems like kind of a tool. Like, one of the things that struck me was the treatment of Rebecca Romijn in the production of this film, considering how little of the movie she is actually in, like, especially as herself, wearing that whole... She plays Mystique, who is a shape-shifting character, and that's represented by her being blue and scaly and nude whenever she's not taking the form of another person. And that required 6 hours a day of
makeup.
It might have been more, because... No, 9 hours. 9 hours a day of makeup application. It would have been six, like, if they had used, like, I think the thing I read kind of conflicting things about how this worked out, but they were going to use food coloring for a lot of her skin, but Bryan Singer wanted it to look opaque because it was, like, truer to how it looks in the comics or something. So that added, like, using that different kind of body paint added a lot of time to her makeup application. And also, I think they wanted to, like, keep her from having any, you know, set photos taken, like, paparazzi or whatever. So she was just sequestered away from the rest of the cast for, like, the entirety of the shoot and kept in this box where they spent all day painting her blue for her, you know, 5 minutes of screen time as a blue person. And it just sounded really unnecessarily horrible.
And as herself, like, when she looks like Mystique, when she's blue, she didn't say a single word in this movie, right?
No, she does say something in the helicopter scene where she's kicking the senator in the face. She's like, people like you are why I was afraid to go to school.
Oh, you're right. And, okay.
And also she has, like, weird voice modulation, which, I don't know, it was kind of cool. They do more with her in the next couple movies, but yeah. Still, it is...
Well, and once Jennifer Lawrence steps into her shoes, she gets a lot of dimension.
She also hated the makeup, so it sounds like they didn't improve that technology terribly. But yeah, it seems like a lot of shit to put an actor through for a stupid reason, considering the willful rejection of all of the other X-Men comic aesthetics, like how proud they were of dressing everyone in black leather instead of anything that resembled their comic get-ups. Because, like, you know, a black leather bodysuit is arguably, yes, more durable than spandex or whatever, but as everyone working on the movie noted, super hard to move around in, not at all easy to be acrobatic or athletic in. So, I don't know, it seemed like, oh, it's the year 2000, every action movie, everyone is dressed in black leather because that's cool. So let's do that also and try to justify it.
Okay.
When Wolverine asks, or when Cyclops asks, what would you prefer, yellow spandex? The answer is yes. That would be fucking cool. I would like to see that once ever in any of these movies.
Yeah, actually, at this point, I would too. It would be like a retro jersey day for a sport.
Because there have, what, been...
40?
At least 40 of these movies. Possibly more, including the spin-offs, and in zero of them has Wolverine worn anything resembling his iconic costume.
No, but as I was mentioning to you earlier, he does evoke a young Clint Eastwood.
Yeah, I'd never seen that before, but when you said that, I thought, yeah, maybe I've even more so than that. Clint Eastwood's own son.
Yeah, I think because he's all squinty and kind of... He's got this sneer. It's like good, bad, and ugly sneer.
And he does have like a kind of weathered look to him.
Yeah, weathered everything. And he gets more weathered as he ages in real life, too.
Even throughout the movie, that was something else I read, that Hugh Jackman was cast 3 weeks into shooting this movie. They were really scrambling to find a Wolverine, and they wanted a lot of people.
Hoskins just isn't available.
He's too old now. We can't.
Who can we use for Wolverine?
That's a funny thing I hadn't considered, though. Bob Hoskins is the right height to play Wolverine.
Oh,
Wolverine
is 5'3". You've always hated that he's too tall.
It's always bothered me. I like Hugh Jackman a lot, and I think he does great in the role in, like, every incarnation, but he's over 6 feet tall. He's supposed to have a short man's complex, and that's supposed to be, like, you know, a pretty integral part of his character, of being this tiny guy who's always trying to fight the big guy, And instead, it's a guy who is much taller than everyone he acts against. And but Bob Hoskins, he would have been plenty short.
I feel like, you know, in our last episode, I waited till the end to comment on the Bechdel test and the Nope friendship test. Mm. And I went into this movie with an expectation of a pass because I knew that there were a number of female characters who had, you know, close to lead roles. Unless I am mistaken, it gets a fail. I don't remember a single scene where the female characters talked to each other. They were in the room together. They were talking to men. But I don't remember them talking to each other at all. They talked about each other sometimes.
No, you're probably right. I feel like I cautioned you against hoping that any of these movies would pass this test within the first, like, decade.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, it's a weird thing with this movie in general. I feel like there are a handful of quips, and kind of like Blade, which we did last episode, a lot of the dialogue is just people telling each other what is happening and what is going to happen, or what just happened. Like, it's super expository, and very little of it is, like, conversation, you know? Uh-huh. Conversation about anything other than the plot.
Although, like, you know, since I saw this movie in the theater, I've remembered it. I haven't remembered it, honestly. Like, I found it very forgettable. I really liked X-Men 2, but in the moment when I saw this, and what my only recollection of it was that I didn't really like it. And I actually really enjoyed it on this rewatch a great deal more than I expected to. I feel like it was still a little bit boring and slow in the way that action movies were until, you know, they evolved into what they are now, but not as bad as Blade by a lot. And part of what attracted me to this project of rewatching all of these movies with you was getting to see the evolution in, you know, not real time, to see it compressed. Mm-hmm. And I was struck by how charismatic Wolverine.
Yeah, man. Hugh Jackman's
Hugh
a star.
Jackman was in that role from the very beginning. Like, it seemed really, in retrospect, it hasn't seemed as clear to me why him, forgetting all the solo movies and being, you know, dragged through every single one of them when other people have come and gone and other characters have gotten less respect. But after rewatching this first one, it seemed really obvious why he would be the one that would have that trajectory.
Now imagine this. Russell Crowe as Wolverine.
I can imagine that.
Do you like that imaginary vision?
I really like Russell Crowe. And, you know, this would be not too far away from when he was ripped for Gladiator. Mm. I mean, it would have been a little bit different, but still sort of an aggressive Aussie.
Well, that's how this came to be. They offered Russell Crowe the role, and he was like, can't do it, I'm busy with something else, but I have this friend who is also Australian.
His name is Guy Pearce.
And that was how Hugh Jackman got his big break, was his old pal Russell Crowe.
What did we know him from before this?
Hugh Jackman? Nothing. Yeah. This was his breakout in America. Like, he might have been in something else, but this was the role that, like, made him. He was an unknown at that point.
Unknown to you, maybe.
No, like, that was, I mean, in my scads of research, that was what it said. That
I don't
before
think you
this,
did that much research.
I did enough. Enough to be 100% certain that before his 40 movies as Wolverine, Hugh Jackman was a nobody in America. He was probably on some British crime shows or soap, or not British, Australian crime dramas or soap operas or something.
Boy, I did not believe you, but I'm looking at his IMDb page now, and he only had a handful of roles before this. So, you win.
Thank you, Russell Crowe.
Yeah. Ugh, then he went on to make Kate and Leopold. Blah.
You know who else was considered for the role of Wolverine?
Was it Nicole Kidman's husband? Because he's also Australian. Keith Urban? Is that his name?
I was like, at that point, it would have been Tom Cruise.
No, I meant her current Australian
Tom
husband.
Tom Cruise, also probably the right height.
Yeah.
But no. Gary Sinise, Keanu Reeves. Those were who Fox was pushing for.
Gary Sinise is a real head scratcher for me.
It would have been
at this point. He was still very much Lieutenant Dan.
It would have been an interesting choice. Like I can kind of imagine it, but also like he's always kind of looked middle aged. So I don't know if that works in favor of Wolverine as this ageless character or not.
I love Keanu Reeves, but you know, I feel like he just is Keanu Reeves. If he's cast in the right role, it totally works. And I think he's proven with his recent John Wick performances that, you know, Neo is not the only action hero you can make him. But at this time, he literally was in the middle of being Neo. That would have been... I mean, I guess there are actors who are in multiple franchises right now and getting away with it. All of their names completely escape me in this moment, but I know that it's true. There's some Star Wars, Star Trek.
Oh, for sure. Like crossovers. Oscar Isaac is
Oscar
in
Isaac, thank you.
Every movie.
Oscar Isaac's in every movie.
Same with John Boyega. He's working constantly.
Yeah. But I mean, I do want to say that Keanu Reeves is breathtakingly hot in person. So I still don't think he would have been right for this role.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the only direction they wished to go that they didn't, that I kind of wish they had, was like since the beginning they wanted to cast Angela Bassett as Storm, and that never came to be. And I think she, I mean, not that there's much for her to work with in any of the movies really, but
she does have a really kind of badass presence though. I could see that.
Yeah.
But okay, let's talk about Rogue for a second here. Anna Paquin, you know, I like her. But I think if you look at this movie, where it falls on the spectrum of her career after The Piano and before True Blood, I, considering that she was nominated for an Oscar when she was like 12, I don't think that she has a ton of range. And I feel like the performance that she gave in this movie was consistent with the performance that she's given in everything else I've seen her in. Based on your knowledge of canon, would you say that she was a good choice and that was a good performance for this character?
I mean, for the characterization they went with, sure, she was fine. But, like, what they did with Rogue in this was she was sort of an amalgam of multiple characters. Like, the story they told with her was pretty much the introductory story of Kitty Pryde, who is the girl you briefly see run through a wall, who later is played by Ellen Page to a greater importance to the plot, and Jubilee, who is a girl you briefly see who has no lines, who has, like, a yellow jacket and big hoop earrings and shoots fireworks from her hands, and she's, like, the one that Wolverine gets attached to and is sort of a mentorish, fatherish figure to for a while. And Rogue herself is... She's in I'm more familiar with the X-Men cartoon than I am with the comics. I've only got into the X-Men comics more recently, but mostly what I know of Rogue, she's a brassy Southern belle who has flight, super strength, and the one power they did stick with her here is that she can, you know, kill you by touching you, sucking out your life force. She's mostly the romantic interest of Gambit, who hasn't really had much of a showing in any of the movies, but also
he's been cast for an upcoming one, hasn't he?
They keep trying
Isn't
to make it
Channing Tatum.
That's something they keep trying to do, is a Gambit movie with Channing Tatum and that other guy who John Carter of Mars. Taylor Kitsch, is that a person?
Taylor Swift is a person.
But this dude, they kept trying to get his career off the ground, and he played Gambit in the once again exiled X-Men Origins Wolverine, and didn't really represent what Gambit is in that either. But yeah, basically for what they were doing with Rogue here, of having her be the fresh-faced teen newcomer damsel in distress kind of character, Anna Paquin was fine, but as a representation of Rogue as she exists elsewhere, pretty dull and weak.
It's funny that Anna Paquin gets cast as Southerners a lot, because she is a New Zealander, technically Canadian, but spent her formative years in New Zealand, neither of which translates obviously to brassy Southern belle or Southern fairy. or Southern anything.
Well, the impression I get from British and Australian and New Zealander actors is that they all feel like they can easily transition into a Southern accent as far as American accents go. Whether they're correct about that or not varies, but it seems to be an easier thing to take on than a non-regional American dialect. But Hugh Jackman fucking kills it.
Yeah, he's great. Simon Baker.
Who?
Simon Baker. He also is in L.A. Confidential with Guy Pearce and Russell Crowe. In that one, he plays the blonde up-and-coming star who gets set up by Danny DeVito in a hotel room, but you might know him better as The Mentalist.
Oh, what does he have to do with anything?
He's Australian, too. Was he ever considered for the role of Wolverine?
No. I think Doug Ray Scott, who...
He's Welsh, isn't he?
Yeah. He's Scottish, I think.
Okay, for our purposes, let's say that everyone is Australian.
Definitely not American.
Born in Scotland, trained at the Welsh College of Music and Drama. So we're both kind of right about Doug Ray.
I think...
He's Scottish, but he went to school in Wales. So
I think Halle Berry and James Marsden might be the Australian. Only American. No, he's American.
Everybody's Australian.
Everyone else.
But here's another question. You're never going to get to talking about the plot of this movie.
Whatever. Because who fucking cares?
I am really enjoying our Q&A here. So am I correct in understanding that this movie is the genesis of the charming friendship between Sir Ian McKellen and Sir Patrick Stewart?
I want to say no. Let me see if that's in my notes. I feel like those guys had to have known each other prior.
Now, they're both English. But I don't think Patrick Stewart is in any of the Harry Potter movies.
Neither is Ian McKellen.
Ooh, that's a major oversight on somebody's part. No,
Patrick Stewart was too busy. They backed different horses. Patrick Stewart backed the X-Men trilogy, and Ian McKellen split his time between that and the Lord of the Rings trilogy. They actually shaped the shooting schedule of this movie to accommodate Ian McKellen so he could... Paul asked to New Zealand to go be Gandalf.
But didn't he have to step in and be Dumbledore?
No, that's Michael Gambon.
For the first three, and then...
No, Michael Gambon took over for Dead Man.
I think you're mistaken. I think Ian McKellen takes over for Michael Gambon.
You're 100% wrong, because Michael Gambon isn't dead, and the guy who was the original Dumbledore 100% is. Oh, why can't I remember his name? I want to say Richard something. Or something Richards.
You're starting to sound correct.
Either way, I'm disgracing the dead. But I guarantee you,
Harris.
Yeah, Richard Harris. I was right. That Ian McKellen was not both Dumbledore and Gandalf.
I have always thought that he was.
He could have been.
I always thought that it was Gandalf who took over.
He would have been a badass Dumbledore. Maybe you're just confused because Dumbledore is gay and so is Ian McKellen, and they're both wizards.
That is really possible.
Oh, and another thing you might like to know, one of the rewrites of the script done by Joss Whedon.
I do like to know that.
Only, he said, according to him, only a handful of his lines made it all the way through to the final rewrite, and one of them is notoriously the worst line in the movie, when Toad is hanging on to that railing by his tongue and Storm comes out and asks, you know what happens when a toad is struck by lightning?
Same thing that happens to everybody else.
Right, and according to Joss Whedon, he meant that line to be sort of like a goofy throwaway. Like, she asks the question without knowing the answer. She asks, you know, like, Toad is supposed to look at her like, I don't know what, and then she's supposed to be like, I don't know, the same thing that happens to everything else, and then he gets struck by lightning, but with her delivery, it just sounds super weird.
Yeah.
And, I don't know. I think that's...
Should we call out, did he write the best line in the movie, too? Because I bet he did.
Which?
Where James Marsden makes Wolverine prove that it's really him.
Yes, he did.
Yeah, and then Wolverine's like,
That was the other line.
That was so good.
He was happy that one still got a laugh.
Yeah. Joss Whedon is a treasure. That man is a national treasure.
But our nation? Whedon doesn't sound like an American name, and neither does Joss.
He's Australian.
Really? So, should we burn through the plot of this film?
I mean, they did. Why shouldn't we?
Right. Like, we labored so hard trying to get straight the plot of Blade, and I felt that was kind of a wasted effort in the end, given what that plot was, and this one, I feel, is similarly not worth that much effort. Basically, Rogue is a teen. She almost accidentally kills her boyfriend with her powers.
Let's stay here for a second, though, because, okay, so Rogue and a boy are making out, mm-hmm. only her name is still...
Marie?
Martha?
Sounds I think, stupid. I'm pretty sure... Martha, okay. Martha would be appropriate for comic books.
Yeah, so her...
she is a woman, though she's not a mother.
She's not She'll a mother. She'll have to change so her name when she has kids. So probably her mom's name's Martha. So Definitely. She's making out with a boy on a bed, and it seems like a girl's room, right? So she's making out with him on her bed, and then he starts getting all veiny and having his life force sucked out. And she goes, you know, like screamy mm-hmm. scream. And adults, who are presumably her parents... Mm-hmm. Who are both doing very mundane things in the house in the afternoon. So, like, everybody's home in the afternoon. Maybe it's a weekend. I don't know. But they come running in to see what's going on, and man parent is like, call 911. And woman parent, I think she stands there. But Rogue like, huddles in a corner.
We don't have cell phones yet. It's the year 2000.
Yeah. It's the near future.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. The not too distant future. So Rogue is like, don't touch me. But... then she tells Logan later, the first boy I ever kissed was in a coma for 3 weeks. So that's got to be that boy, right? Mm-hmm. And so are we to assume that she's never had an instance of that happening before where she touched somebody and then sucked their life force out because it manifests in puberty, mm-hmm. right? And so why does she believe that nobody should touch her when it was kissing him that sucked the life force?
That was...
like, it seemed like a stupid thing?
It seemed like a leap. Like, you know, like, I mean, it's such a traditional thing in superhero things for them to be like, oh, I seem to have this weird ability. Let's, you know, test out the limits and see what it all means. For her to be like, oh, I kissed this boy for a second. I now know the full breadth of my ability to kill. But also... That was totally something I was wondering about. Like, how does she so instantly know what's going on here? Except for maybe that, like, she's, you know, or later she says, I still feel him in my head or whatever. Like, maybe
yeah.
as she was killing him, she felt, like, his life force transferring to her and is now, you know, freaked out about that enough that she has some sort of grasp on how... dangerous she is.
You know, talking about it, I'm pretty sure the reason I didn't like this movie when it was out originally is that there's huge blank spots. It's like quick. Like, you know, there's so much that they really do race through the plot without giving you a lot of characterization, mm-hmm. like you were saying about the dialogue. However, because this is the first of 70 or 80 movies, mm-hmm. you know, like all that stuff has been filled in since then, and so I was able to project onto these weak characters the strengths of the future iterations.
Right.
And so that really stood out to me as a stupid moment, but I think a lot of the Wolverine stuff struck me as stupid when I saw it in 2000 because he hadn't been fleshed out yet, and now it was, like, so charming to see young Hugh Jackman, you know, doing his thing and being so charismatic already without being quite as jacked as he gets in the later films, as I believe you commented on.
Well,
he's so small.
Yeah, well, that was another funny thing is because he was cast 3 weeks into shooting,
oh.
he gets progressively more jacked throughout the filming process as he, you know, realizes that this character is supposed to be buff and is working out all the time throughout the filming process. So some scenes he is normal. I mean, even then... at no point in this movie did he appear to be as jacked as modern-day Jackman.
Some days I feel like... I actually think of him... he's one of the actors that I think of when I think of this, but I think it would be nice to... like, if your job was being a supermodel or a superhero or whatever it is for the screen, then you'd get paid a whole lot of money to have a team of people manage your physique. Like, mm-hmm. Everybody be monitoring you all the time. They'd prepare your special meals, and you'd work out 4 or 5 hours a day. And then you'd wind up looking like Wolverine or The Rock or, you know, any of these people who do it. But our sister Wendy turned me on to Chris Pratt's Instagram feed, where he likes to play a game where you have to guess what snack it is that he's going to have, I guess. And then you get to see what that, the meal restriction and nutritional management and stuff that mm-hmm. goes into having that physique. There's a reason you have to get paid that much to do it. Because it seems like the worst.
Yeah, they all always talk about totally, like, Chris Evans, Hugh Jackman, Chris Pratt. They all are pretty vocal about hating, especially Hugh Jackman. He's been doing this for 17 years.
Yeah.
So, it's got to totally suck. I mean, like, Hugh Jackman and Chris Evans, like, those two characters, like, let's get those guys out of their shirts as often as possible. But Chris Pratt, it's like, you know, why is his character supposed to be jacked as hell? So it seems like even more of a load to bear for
at a single standard. Yeah, I think I mean, like, really, his tummy should be showing the whole time if it was gonna be single standard. But
like him being, if all the girls have fit, to be anorexic, like,
it makes sense that he would him have to being be all like jacked.
You know, the most muscular man in the world. Like, I think, like, he shouldn't be competing with Dave Bautista when.
It sells tickets, dude. Shut up.
I'm whatever. Fair enough.
If all the guys who are bummed they can't go to the Alamo screenings of Wonder Woman, you know, their motivation for being bummed about that, I'm good for you, Anna Faris, is all I've got to say about that. Anyway, I stopped you at Rogue sucking the life force out of her boyfriend and immediately understanding the scope of her powers.
Right. I think
and that's... And then she's like, she's telling him, just before she sucks his life force out, she's showing him her bedazzled map of the...
Her vision board.
North America on her wall, where she's showing him that she's gonna go on a road trip to Alaska.
To beautiful northern Canada.
I thought she was going to Alaska.
I mean, it seemed like she was just going anywhere was north and icy.
Alaska specifically. I'm 99% sure. But maybe. Then, I don't know, then she's like, okay, so she must have stayed home long enough to find out that he was in a coma for 3 weeks before she... But it seems like she's just gone and cutting ties with her parents and she's a minor. Like, there's a lot of things that are problematic about her packing a duffel and hitting the road and hitchhiking. All apparently hitchhiking all the way from whatever, you know, Normalsville, USA, she sucks the life force out of that boy in.
The South.
And, yeah, that makes sense. It probably said on the screen.
They definitely said, like, yeah.
She's in Mississippi.
So in the near future.
She's in the near future in Mississippi. She sucks her boyfriend's life force out and then immediately understands the scope of her powers, somehow knows that he's in a coma for 3 weeks, packs the world's largest duffel bag, and carries it hitchhiking. And she's like, hey, trucker, I thought you were taking me to this city. And he's like, this is that city. But it's like a warehouse where there's a fight club. So the question that I had in the moment is, why did she want to go there?
Because it's not an adventure if you aren't getting lost in snowy Canada. She definitely says, like, her boyfriend objects and is like, why do you want to go to places where it's cold and sucks? And she's like, because it's not an adventure if it's not cold.
The way they presented it really seemed like she was looking for Wolverine because she found him and hooked up with him immediately without there being any clear reason for this teenage girl.
Will of the Force.
To go hang out with this, you know, technically middle-aged guy.
Well, technically like 100-year-old guy. I think he's...
I mean, like in human...
In human years, in real he's like 30.
How old was he at that time?
Probably like 30 something, 32, I would guess.
Okay. Well, then young, very young guy.
Older than a teenager.
So he's like...
At least twice her age.
Too old for that to be romantic.
Definitely. I mean, well, like I said, they're roughly basing her on... Jubilee at this point, who is also a teenager who is taken under the wing of Wolverine.
He's born in 68, 78, 88, 98, 2000. So you're right, 32.
Right on the fucking head.
Language.
Swearing is cool. Ask any kid, they'll tell you. Kids know it's cool.
I was talking about
you, hanging out with middle-aged men. Cool.
I was talking about you and your swearing on the podcast to our niece today. I was telling her that we were going to do this, and that she wanted to watch the movie with us, and I told her I thought it would be too scary for her. And then I was talking to her mom, our sister, about the podcast, and then our niece wanted to know if the podcast would also be too scary for her. And I was telling her, no, but that Tom uses bad words.
Too sweary.
And then she was like, what words? And I said, I can't say them because they're naughty. And she said, they're funny.
She'll catch on quick. I need to start teaching her some swears, I guess.
Oh, that'd be so cute.
I know.
Okay, so I accidentally got us back on track with the plot. She goes to Canada randomly.
Mm-hmm.
She goes to Fight Club Canada. Wolverine is winning the Fight Club. And then he gets in a real life fight with bar people.
Somehow no one...
After hours.
I wonder how long he's been at this fight club. He drives a camper, so he obviously lives on the road.
He's totally like the Hulk in this, though, because, mm-hmm. like, he stays around until somebody makes him mad and sees his claws.
He is Canadian, and though, so he must not be traveling terribly far.
He's Australian.
Oh. Same thing.
Yeah.
But no one notices he's a mutant until now. Like, even though, I mean, the guy he fights is like, you must have cheated because... No one gets in a fight and comes out with no bruises. And Wolverine's like, I'm fucking Wolverine. I'll chop your head off with my hand swords. But that this dude was the first one to notice. Even though the fight announcer is like, don't kick him in the balls because that'll make him angry. Unlike most people, they're pretty cool with it usually. But this guy, takes it personal. Like, for the fight announcer to... be that familiar with Wolverine's quirks, but for no one to have realized that this guy who sounds like clanging metal when you punch him and suffers no injury in any fight is not a mutant. Anyway, he busts out his hand swords at the dude, and then the bartender's like, get on out of here, mutant. And then he chops the bartender's gun in half and skedaddles. And interesting note, Wolverine doesn't kill anyone in this movie.
Oh, okay, so then Rogue hides in the trailer hanging off of his mobile home where his motorcycle is. And while he's driving really fast on a highway in the snow, he hears something that catches his attention and deduces that it is that?
Does he have
super hearing?
He definitely has super smelling that we see immediately after that scene. So
that was stupid too. Like, I thought she was going to be in the back of his camper.
Yeah, that would have made sense.
Like making food or cleaning or something.
Or hiding. Like bumping into something while hiding. Like that.
But no.
That definitely seemed like the obvious choice. Also, weird thing for him to have a tow along trailer holding his motorcycle, which is never featured again. Instead, later, he is depicted stealing Cyclops' motorcycle.
I was going to say that, too, but then I remembered that there was a colossal explosion that took out his motorhome, and it stands to reason that the trailer and motorcycle would be damaged, too.
True.
Let's just
He's just a motorcycle enthusiast in general.
So he finds her, and then he's like, get out of here. And then she's like, oh, I'm a kid. And he's like, all right, you can come with me, and we'll be friends.
He's a softie.
And then she's like, do you have any food? And he gives her something, and she eats it like...
I think it's jerky.
It looks like jerky.
Seems like jerky for it to be something.
She's not struggling to eat it. I think it was like fake jerky.
I mean,
it was like chocolate.
It's questionable what it was in reality, but in the movie, I think it's supposed to be
jerky.
They're
driving along. It's a road trip movie. They're having a good time. A tree falls in front of them.
Chatting about being weirdos.
Right when they're talking about seatbelt safety. And it turns out that it's been put there by Sabretooth, who comes out of nowhere to try to kidnap one of them. Looks like it's Wolverine. Fighty, fight, fight. And then the X-Men come in and savey, save, save.
I'm not too hot on this message about seatbelt safety where it's like, hey, Wolverine, why aren't you buckling up? This is dangerous. And he's like, don't tell me how to drive. And then crashes and is immediately vaulted through the windshield. But then the counterpoint is Rogue is pinned into her seat and cannot get the seatbelt undone. So it's like, Which is it? Do I buckle up or do I burn to death in this wreckage in a seatbelt I can't undo?
You're right. It is a mixed message about seatbelt safety.
Also, doesn't amount to anything. X-Men come, get them out of the car, pick up Wolverine.
Cut to skedaddle black.
Once more.
Like, cut to black. Like, let's not deal with any of the intermediary stuff. Let's just everybody wake up in the lab. And then, okay, so Wolverine wakes up when Jean Grey is plunging a syringe of something into his arm.
She's trying to take a blood sample, I figured.
He puts her in a headlock and escapes from her and then follows Professor X's voice in his head to where he is. However, I thought that scene rang true. That, like, he would be freaked out if he woke up in a lab, mm-hmm. even though he has no memory of being in the lab. He's having nightmares about it.
Yeah, has some sort
he
of
has a sense of PTSD being in that over space. It. But then, like, he gets upstairs. Professor X is like, hey, I can project my voice into your head. I'm cool. Look, that girl you rescued, she's here. She goes to high school now. It happened while you were asleep. You've only been here for 5 minutes. Now, relax with me and I'll give you a tour of the place. And Wolverine's like, okay.
He's won over pretty easily.
Yeah, I considering mean, all the baggage that guy brings in.
He does have a lot of baggage. He's an
amnesiac fighter.
They have already established that he is a softie.
Yeah, he gave that girl his jerky.
And he let her ride didn't in his leave car. Her. Yeah, he didn't kill those people who pulled a gun on him. He's a much different Wolverine from what we will see in the future. He's a regular marshmallow. Truly.
Okay. So anyway, okay. So I feel like I got us someplace and we should just go from there because I can't think of anything worth dwelling on in the stuff I just skimmed through.
We see a lot of the kids with their really stupid, useless powers, like some jerk who can run on water. And
but that's during the tour. He's like, yeah, this is a tour of the school.
And yeah, that's I really like it's like a montage mixed with a conversation so that like you're like, at what pace is this conversation being had that it's like, one sentence, now we're in a different room. Continuing sentence, like, what were you guys talking about in between walking from the basketball courts to the stables?
A, it's none of your business, and B, it explains why he mellowed out so fast.
True. I also wondered,
mysterious,
in those stables, are those all the horses, or is one of those horses a mutant?
Are all of the horses mutants?
Oh, mutant horses. They're just taking care
students
of everybody.
Students brushing other students.
Xavier's school.
Yeah. So he starts to mellow out.
Rogue is in her classes. All the kids are like, ooh, the new girl, let's show off for her. Flame Boy is like, look, I made a ball of fire in my hand. Oh. Ice Boy is like, I froze your ball of fire,
boring.
And then I made
Go
you a rose.
It. Go past it.
Well, it just kind of matters because Ice Boy matters to the okay. plot later.
Okay, fine.
Also gets to continue being in these movies, even though he's boring as hell.
Boring as hell. But, okay, so Xavier convinces Wolverine, give me 48 hours to figure out why Magneto is trying to kidnap you, and I will reciprocate by trying to figure out what happened to you. And so they put him in the X-ray machine, find out that he has the adamantium
skeleton,
essentially. So all of that is happening, and then it's nighttime. This is the next thing where I was like, what the what? So Rogue is lying in bed in a dormitory full of high school-aged kids, apparently sleepless, and she walks into Logan's bedroom, which I guess is in the same place as all the child bedrooms, so that seems foolish. And then he's having a nightmare, but she goes without gloves, so she can't touch him to wake him up, like, which would be stupid anyway.
It seems
it's
odd
like
that
a
she would ever
thing.
Not be wearing gloves, except for, like,
yes,
to brush her teeth or
stupid.
Something.
And so she's like, Logan, wake up. Hey, wake up. And so he wakes up, just like with the Jean Grey thing, where he wakes up choking her and stabs Rogue with all of his razor claws through the chest. And then she touches him to get his healing powers. And then everybody's a little bit weirded out. But nobody comments on the questionable situation of 16-year-old-ish girl.
It happens.
Walking into adult man's bedroom in the middle of the night to watch him sleep, I guess? And then him accidentally like, the focus is, oh, she took your powers
dorm
and healed herself.
Dorm life, you know?
Yeah, like, that whole thing made me very uncomfortable. Like,
Wolverine definitely should have locked his door.
Yeah, somebody should have.
It's a questionable situation all around. Also, that Rogue would know that touching him would transfer power to her. It seems like she's probably never touched a mutant before, so good thing that worked out.
So was that, like, revenge gone right? Like, she was touching him for revenge and it wound up going right, or accidentally touched him and it wound up going right?
I think it was intentional. I mean, the most I can assume is that it was, you know, her being like, well, might as well, you know, I'm dying here, gotta try something.
I don't like it. Another thing I skipped over just then is right before this bedtime bizarreness, James Marsden is tucking Wolverine in for the night, essentially, when he catches him and Jean Grey having some chemistry. And I had totally forgotten that Jean Grey and Cyclops are already roommates. At the school, they're roommates, if you get my meaning. Yes. When Wolverine comes on the scene, I forgot that love triangle started with them as an established couple, and that he never did have a chance.
Yeah, that's canonical. That's always sort of a thing, but all of the X-Men fuck, more or less. Like, even though there's always that love triangle between those three, Wolverine gets around.
Yes, that is the impression I get.
Most, like, I think his most consistent relationship is with Storm, which is something they never get into in the movies.
Huh, that's a shame.
They really don't get into his romance at all. And, like, I mean, in one of the standalone Wolverine movies, they get into one of them a little, but it's super minor even than that. In general, it's not a plot element.
Anyway, so then the next day, he is recovering from having his life force sucked, but he's more concerned about Rogue and her well-being. And this is another thing. Mystique gets on campus. Like, what's the security in this place?
She gets around in a physical sense, in that she is always everywhere and pretending to be someone else.
Yeah, so she pretends to be Ice Boy and is like, hey, know how I had a crush on you 5 minutes ago? Well, now I think you're super creepy, Rogue. You should get out of here. Everybody hates
you. Everyone hates you for touching Wolverine like that.
I'm gonna take your word on that, and I'm just gonna run away.
Wolverine is seriously our dude, and no one likes the way you touched him, so please leave immediately.
Yeah.
And she's like, I think he's right. I need to get out of here. And she does.
But it doesn't come out ever. They never acknowledge that Mystique was on campus. She goes from there.
Well, it wouldn't be a surprise if you knew already.
Well, but no, she goes into Professor X's ballroom. CyberOps, what's its name?
Cerebro.
She goes into CyberOps and she adds some
juice
to its juice thing.
Oh, right. She changes the blue Gatorade to green Gatorade.
She does. And then she goes away completely undetected. Now, later, after the Gatorade switch has affected Professor X by putting him in a convenient coma that lasts exactly as long as they need him out of the way, Jean Grey has the presence of mind to go look into Cerebro. Nobody's there when he gets affected by it, but she's like, you know what? I bet it's the Gatorade. So she goes into Cerebro, opens the controlly drawer, and fixes the Gatorade.
Maybe she just wanted a cup of that sweet sweat punch and cracked it open to see what was in there and noticed it was green.
But nobody talks about security. It's supposed to be Gatorade Frost. There's not a moment there where anybody's like, how did this happen? Someone has broken through our security. It might have been Mystique. Anyway, I thought that was a real...
The Gatorade in general is a super weird nonsense plot device of like, all right, how do we get Professor X out of this? We don't want to deal with a guy in a wheelchair at the Statue of Liberty. This is just... Everything about this is way too complicated. Like, we don't want to have to think up any use for his powers in this situation. Can we just give him some bad Gatorade and put him in a coma for the next 15 minutes, and then he'll wake up after that and ask how it went, and everyone will be like, it was great.
And it was, you know, I'm sure that that's one of the things that when I saw it originally took me out of it in a way that made me not enjoy the movie, was that, and I know, again, like Blade, this is a pre-9/11 movie, but this one, unlike Blade, is post-Columbine. And so the idea that someone could walk onto a school campus, like that somebody could compromise the school's security, especially like a special school like this one, without anyone even commenting on it through the entire film, struck me as so unnecessarily unrealistic.
Did they ever figure it out either? It doesn't seem like they ever figured it out. Like, yeah.
They fixed the Gatorade. There's never a comment about how that happened. Nobody ever corrects Rogue about it not actually having been Ice Boy to say those mean things to her.
He doesn't. Well,
there's like, never a moment where he's like, I didn't say that to you. They never figured it
out. I guess they
would. We, the audience, know.
Like, I wonder if that's why they had to have the Gatorade contrivance.
And then she's playing freaking ping pong with him, and at the end of the movie, like, all is forgiven. But, like, there's never a scene. Oh, yeah, you're right. But, like, there's never a scene where he's like, I never had that conversation with you. He tells his friends that she stood him up for lunch. I totally get why I did not like this movie in 2000. And they're lucky that I've seen all 38 to 70 of the movies since then. Mm-hmm. And, you know, was able to project
everything
some
is in service of this nonsense plot of Magneto turning some world leaders into mutants. Like, nothing about that makes sense to me, but everything works out to make that. Because, like, that's like, I figure the Gatorade contrivance is about if anyone could not literally sniff out, since Wolverine is obviously capable of this, but mentally detect that someone is not who they are, it would be Professor Xavier, and if he's had some bad Gatorade, then that's not a problem anymore. But still, I don't know. Also, like, Jean Grey, she is also a telepath, as well as having telekinetic powers, but they really, really underpower her telepathy in this one, so it's like, oh, you know, I'm just learning how to read minds and whatnot. I can't use Cerebro yet. I'm not good at it like the professor is yet, even though I don't think it's really commented on in this one, but it's definitely a large part of the plots of the next two X-Men movies, is that Jean Grey is, like, the most powerful mutant alive.
A thing that we didn't comment on, because we were eager to talk about the stupidity of that make-out scene, the movie opens in the Holocaust.
To say we totally skipped over the concentration camp
so
intro.
Young Magneto is being separated from
Eric
his parents.
Lyncha.
In a concentration camp where he demonstrates that he has his power then. Like, mm-hmm. Maybe that's the first time it's manifested or whatever, but while he's being restrained
by a moment
by
of stress near puberty, as Jean Grey will later explain to some sort of congressional hearing.
Oh, yeah. Senators, I think.
It was a weird sci-fi looking building, so who the hell knows what it was or where.
I had a picture of the United States Capitol or the White House on the wall, though, so you know it was government.
And it is the near future, that's what Congress looks
like. It was a lit-up picture. Anyway, so he demonstrates that he can move metal in that moment of stress, and then he mentions later that he came through Ellis Island in 1949.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I think it's 1944 in the opening scene when he's taken into the concentration camp.
I'll take your word for it. I don't know.
I'm 90%
sure. Sounds right, though.
So we're to believe that, I mean, there's just nothing about, like, why show us that first scene of him having those powers manifest in that moment and then mention that he helped build Cerebro, that he came to New York in 1949. They give us these, like, specific momentary details about his development as a person.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that the whole concentration camp thing was to draw a direct parallel between how the Jews were treated in World War II and how the mutants are being treated in the society depicted in this, and unfortunately how a lot of real people are being treated today. I don't know. It was a very intense opening for not a lot of clarity about what happened next with him.
Yeah, I mean, it will, like, I get what you mean. Like, I mean, it is part of his character. It, like, Magneto, originally, that was not really an explicit part of his character, but they cooked it up in the late 80s, where they went into his backstory more and explained how he escaped Nazi Germany. Yeah, it is a very intense and, like, it's the most intense and striking imagery in the whole movie, and kind of isn't earned by the rest of the movie, where you don't see anything comparable to that throughout. Like, there's, you know, like, there's all this talk of the government wanting to do this and that to oppress mutants, but you never see any evidence of that in motion, other than, like, a couple brief scenes where you see, like, I couldn't tell, I guess they were in support of the senator dude who wants to imprison all the mutants, or register all the mutants, but, you know, you never see, they never draw that parallel starkly enough in the modern times for it to really pay off. Like, it's the sort of thing where, like, they could have gotten that effect similarly just by, like, briefly showing you Magneto's tattoo rather than... But I also think they wanted to be, like... They just wanted that cool scene of him.
For sure.
But also, it's like, man, if that kid... Like, what's to keep them from... You know, the Nazis were... The real Nazis in the real world were already doing experiments on Jewish prisoners. So... How does this kid, who obviously has magic powers, escape that other than killing his way out with his newly found magic powers?
Yeah.
What happened here?
Thank you. That's where I was on my way to. It was too dramatic a moment in every sense to just leave there.
And I'm not familiar enough with his origin story to know exactly how that's supposed to play out.
Anyway, where did we leave off when we were in there?
Rogue hits the road. She goes to a train. They follow her to the train station after... Oh, yeah. After the bad Gatorade, then... No, this isn't the bad Gatorade.
This is before the bad Gatorade.
This is when the first use of Cerebro, where Professor X figures out where Rogue went, and then they go to the train station to recover her. Wolverine steals... Cyclops's turbocharged motorcycle to nitrous boost his way to the future. He gets to the train and is like, hey, no one actually dislikes you. Whoever told you that was being dishonest. Please come home. And before she can come home, Wolverine is frozen in place as Magneto tears the train car open with his magnet powers and then zaps Wolverine away and knocks him out, I guess.
Wolverine's like, what do you want me? And he's like, who said I wanted you? Ooh, he wants Rogue the whole time. Let's talk about James Marsden for a second here.
What about him?
So another part of what I didn't like about this movie when it came out originally is I didn't like James Marsden. I thought he was so vanilla. I could not understand why Jean Grey would be into him over Wolverine. And it's so funny because I love James Marsden now, and although he had a number of comedic roles in things that I saw after the X-Men franchise began, it was Death at a Funeral in 2010 was the first time I saw him in something. It was like, I like him. And then I started remembering, oh, you know, I liked him in Enchanted. I liked him in Zoolander. Like, there's a bunch of other stuff that he did that was funny in the interim, but it wasn't until Death at a Funeral where he's like tripping balls and he's nude in a particularly funny moment for him that I warmed up to him. And so looking at this now, I still didn't like him in this. I still thought he was so boring and vanilla through most of it.
Now you understand the character of a Cyclops.
He's so vanilla.
That's what he is. That's the defining trait of Cyclops. He's a boring, stuck-up, vanilla nothing. And no one knows why anyone likes him. Eventually, he goes crazy and dies. But, he sucks. He always sucks. He always will suck. And, James Marsden did him proud.
Okay.
Yeah.
I like him in Westworld.
He's a fine guy. Cyclops is a bad character.
Okay.
Also, like, Cyclops is ostensibly the leader of the X-Men, but really Storm takes leadership roles more frequently.
Also boring.
Because no one likes Cyclops ever.
She was so boring in this.
Yeah.
I remember her from the cartoons being somebody who, you know, I think Angela Bassett, imagining her in that role, I totally buy that. And Halle Berry, I love Halle Berry, but somebody boringed up Storm.
Yeah, I think that's partially because they wanted... I mean, it's kind of the problem that most of the X-Men movies run into, which is their Wolverine movies.
Yeah, it really was.
Like, no one else can have the spotlight, and especially no one else can have a leadership role. And, you know, Cyclops is the christened leader, and Rogue is the de facto leader. and neither of them get to matter.
Rogue is the de facto
leader? Not Rogue, Storm.
Oh, okay.
Like, yeah, in the cartoon, Storm is super dramatic and super badass and intensely powerful, and that, like, she has a lot of wild arcs and doesn't get to do anything in any of the movies.
Hmm. Okay.
Also is apparently supposed to be Kenyan in this, like...
No. I thought that was a weak Jamaican accent that she was half-heartedly doing.
I never knew what accent it was supposed to be until I was...
It comes and goes.
Researching it. And in the next movie, she doesn't do an accent at all.
Yeah, so. I was really surprised by the accent.
So, yeah, it was nice to put a name to it, but not...
She cuts her hair in the other ones, too, right?
Doesn't she have a
cooler hairdo?
She has a different hairdo in every movie, pretty much.
Okay.
Rogue always has pretty cool hair. Especially, I mean, God, why do I keep saying Rogue?
I don't know. It was confusing.
I mean, Rogue does have cool hair,
but
Storm.
You meant Wolverine.
That's something else you noted.
I noticed
Wolverine
that.
Must be styling his hair to look like the horns from his costume they don't use. Because there are scenes where when he wakes
disheveled.
Up from his various unconsciousnesses, he just has, you know, kind of bedhead.
Messy hair, yeah. And then he's like, I need a double pompadour.
Yeah, he's like, give me some pomade in 20 minutes,
I
want to
look like I just walked out of Oz. Like, the real one. Not that one from the recently canceled Emerald City. Let's see what Oz would be like if it was dark. Anyway. Okay, so Magneto steals Rogue and blah, 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 takes her to the Statue of Liberty where he's going to use her in his mutant-making machine.
Well, before this, we see the mutant-making machine where he has some island villain
It's like
base.
Skull Island, I think.
I mean, it's not shaped like a skull.
No, but isn't that what every island lair is called?
I feel like if you're going to call it Skull Island, it has to resemble a skull. Probably Magneto Island.
Magneto
Island. Mutant Island.
Mutant Island.
The Island of the Brotherhood of Mutants.
Island of the Brotherhood of Mutants.
Yes. This is the thing I don't like. They kidnap the senator. I can never remember his name. Doesn't matter.
Senator Smug.
I'm going to say Senator Kelly.
Sure, that sounds right.
They kidnap him and take him to the island base and strap him into a metal chair. And Magneto's like, you're gonna be a mutant now, bud. Check it out. And he gets into his machine, grips these handles, and a bunch of rings start whirling about him, and some pulsating CG light expands in
and
a bubble.
And he's like channeling Christopher Reeve when he goes into the...
Yeah, there's the weird
chamber
morphing,
in Superman
blurring effect.
Too.
It's a very weird effect to use. And also, like, I don't understand how any of this... I mean, we learn that he helped build Cerebro, so he must be some sort of scientific mind. He also builds a helmet that can block out Professor Xavier's power. So he's definitely, like, some sort of science genius.
Very good at engineering.
But I'm not... I can't work out how magnet powers translate into powering this machine that spins... rings around, and then the ring spinning makes a field that activates genes, like
the X gene.
It's all sci-fi nonsense, so it's not like it's gonna make sense one way or another. But it is an odd god machine. So anyway, they turn this senator into a jellyfish man. Jellyfish Man slips through the bars of his island prison and washes up on shore, and everyone's like, oh, that's that senator who hates mutants, and now he's a gross jellyfish man.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, he is nude.
He is nude.
And everybody's reacting to him like, oh, it's so weird that a jellyfish man just walked up on shore, but nobody's reacting to him like a nude man is walking through a beach full of children.
You know he's uncomfortable about it because he immediately snatches some conveniently placed clothes from just wherever. Someone left their pants and shirt on the beach.
What kind of society is Hollywood writing from where I can't think of a single movie where somebody, like in every freaking superhero movie, think about it. Like in Luke Cage it happens, in the Hulk it happens. Every single episode of the show and every single movie, there's all these instances of superheroes needing some clothes for one reason or another, and finding some immediately. So here's this guy. He's been a mutant for 5 minutes, and he's already able to tap into that network of discarded clothes that fit him.
At least Luke Cage pulls his off of a clothesline. Like, yeah,
a lot of them.
We can accept this as a place where you would find clothes, but pretty much all the other ones just like, oh, good. Someone either left their clothes here on the beach, which, I mean, yeah, I guess you would take some, like, there's some clothes that you would take off at the beach, like, maybe, like, a shirt or something, but pants. I find it hard to believe someone would find pants at the beach. So, Blob Man makes his way to the X-Men and is like, I need help. I couldn't go to the real hospital because they hate mutants as much as I do. And they're like, well, it's a good thing you didn't die before learning the meaning of irony, bud. And then he starts, like, blobbing out on their operation table. And then once they realize, the X-Men realize, oh, Magneto has a machine that turns people into mutants, but it also kills them. Then Professor X is like, I gotta go get some of that Gatorade. So he goes to Cerebro, but the Gatorade poisons his brain and he passes out. And everyone else is like, man, now that Professor X is unconscious, we gotta go stop this plan. Blob Man dissolves into water.
Jean Grey's like, I'm going in Cerebro to fix the Gatorade. And then she puts on the Cerebro hat and then she is like on the floor and then she's like, I know where he's taking her.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, back to the Statue of Liberty.
So then they get in their jet and Crackwise.
Yeah, he's like, oh, nobody's going to be able to detect our jet. And then he's like, going underneath bridges in Newport.
Yeah, that's
Newport in New York Harbor. And is like putting up this massive, like multiple stories high wake. As he does so, before they put in a fog screen anything, they're like...
It's like, there's a very specific thing that stealth planes do. Like, a stealth plane is not a silent plane or an invisible plane. It's a plane that is specifically designed to deflect radar. So, it's not like a human eyeball or ear will not notice your supersonic jet flying right behind it. Although... They do sort of, with another little punny moment, they're like, Storm cloaks their approach with some, you know,
fog
cover, and a guy on, like, a lookout guy is like, oh, sounds like a storm's coming.
I know.
And then it's like, literally, like a person was. Called yeah. Storm. She's coming.
There she was. So funny. Hilarious. Anyway, so, like, Magneto is going, like, the UN... Like, every world leader is having a garden party to talk about whatever over at the Ellis Island grass. And so Magneto is like, I know, I'm going to convert the metal Statue of Liberty torch into a chamber to hold my thing. And does this without anybody noticing. Like, they don't show you him doing it, but what you're supposed to believe is that every world leader... is on the next island over, and that a magic man is able to fly a new piece up to the top of the Statue of Liberty undetected.
It's probably like that bridge he has in his island fortress where he assembles the piece of metal, one chunk of metal at a time as he walks it. Like, he just, like, you know, carried, like, a bag of scraps with him, and everyone's like, oh, that's an inconspicuous... bag of scraps, that's not a death device, and then he magneted it all together inside the torch without anyone realizing, and yeah, that's also pretty dumb, but...
Can we fast forward through this, because I'm getting so bored remembering this stupid nonsense plot.
There's a bad fight scene in the base of the, Statue of Liberty.
Yeah.
Like, Toad and
the
Sabretooth.
The Wet Sprocket?
Yes. Toad the Wet Sprocket, Sabretooth... and Storm and Mystique and Cyclops
Wolverine.
And like pretty much all of them are
fighting. The characters.
Everyone except for Rogue and Magneto pretty much are fighting down here. And it's a really bad early 2000s fight. Like this is a common thing in fight scenes of this era where it's like everyone suddenly wanted to do wire foo.
Oh my gosh, the part where Halle Berry is like flying towards you and she's got one of her legs up. And like the other kind of one extended. On the ground. Yeah, and it's so like that, awkward that's looking. The thing.
Like again, we touched on this in the Blade episode as well, because the Matrix uses a ton of these aesthetics and wire kung fu, except for in that movie, it's like the best of the best, and in this movie, it is very much not. Like there's this uncanny element to bad wire kung fu where it's like things look way too light when they're supposed to be heavy, and way too heavy when they're supposed to be light. So yeah, like,
she looked heavy.
When people are supposed to be, like, you know, weightlessly floating or flying or whatever, it looks like they're stiffly, precariously hanging there and, like, just trying to keep it together. And when they're supposed to be leaping and landing, it looks like they're, you know,
plopping.
Gently lifting up off the ground and then gently settling back down. Mm. So there's weight in the wrong places at every element, and all of the fight in this sequence is full of that shit. Ray Park being a little dildo, like he sucks.
Yeah, I didn't Toad. Care. I didn't care for that at all. I think the only part of that fight sequence that I kind of enjoyed was when Mystique turns into Wolverine.
That is pretty cool.
And they're fighting each other, but my question is, real Wolverine slices off her claws.
Mm-hmm.
And if you slice part of her off, shouldn't there be some evidence of an injury when she switches back, like where she's missing a chunk out of herself?
I feel like
that's
definitely true. That should be the case.
Because she doesn't get his powers. She just gets his appearance.
It's unclear in this at least. Like, later, in the later movies, they make it seem like Mystique's cells are able to take on the form of, like, any matter or something. Like, that's a huge plot element in Days of Future Past. But in this, she's definitely not replicating adamantium, but there is an earlier bit where she's shapeshifted into a, like, replica of the Statue of Liberty. So she can take the form of a stat, like, I don't know. It's really unclear what matter she can and cannot replicate and to what degree that affects her body. It seems like, yeah, she should be missing fingers or something after that.
Yeah.
Like, she can't just generate matter out of nowhere. But I do like the element of him chopping through her fake blades. That's pretty much the only good part of the fight scene here, is when she is him and he's fighting her. Because then when she turns back into herself, just like the wiriest wire foo, where she's just like, you know, alternatingly CG and real and floating around like a ghost or something and kung fuing him.
It's funny, you know, I hadn't really thought about this before, but you give the character Mystique a lot of credit for being on screen a lot, because the character is in all her different shapes. And so you transfer that credit to the actor, whether it's Rebecca Romijn or Jennifer Lawrence, in the same way you think of all of the clones in Orphan Black being distinct from each other, but really it's just one actress. Mm-hmm. And in both of those situations, even though the experience is really cool, where she's able to be all these different people, when you think back on this movie in particular, she shapeshifted into dudes over and over and over again. And so from a practical perspective, that means that a bunch of dudes who were equity actors got paid well for having a lot of lines on screen, and a woman who spent 9 hours a day in the makeup chair, I mean, she would have had better billing than a lot of the people that she shapeshifted into. But, you know, basically, Rebecca Romijn has, like you said earlier, limited screen time. A bunch of dudes have a lot of screen time, and then she shapeshifts into Storm for like 5 seconds. But I think that's the only time she shapeshifts into another girl in this movie.
Yeah.
And so I don't care for that on, you know, just like in Orphan Black. I love that show so much and I love her performance so much. But I also have mixed feelings about the fact that the rest of the cast is made up of actors, and there's, you know, probably a gender bias in favor of number of men employed on the show as in acting roles. when there may be more female characters, but they're all played by one actress. I really hope that those actresses are being paid well.
It definitely seems like her character existed solely to show off that morphing effect of, like, the scales flipping around and whatnot.
It was a mighty effect.
Yeah, it definitely, it's like...
The morphing?
Oh, wow.
It was mighty.
I didn't catch that. As far as the effects in this movie, that was one of the ones that held up better, surprisingly.
Yeah. Actually, I thought the effects were pretty good. The only one that I thought was really sloppy was Magneto's desktop balls that click each other.
I thought that was pretty obvious, and also when the senator is pushing his face through the bars, I thought it was like a cool idea, but it definitely looked really fakey.
Well, and like if we said that in Blade, the Morphe moments where people were exploding was time cop technology. Mm. I really felt like when the senator was blobbing out, it was Harry Potter technology because it reminded me so much of the early Voldemort stuff, which was happening right around the same time. Like, especially in the first Harry Potter movie when he confronts the professor who has Voldemort coming out of the back of his head. Like, that, the technology for that looked very similar to the senator blobbing out.
Yeah.
He also reminded me of those new edible water bottles that you see on the internet, where it's a little sphere of edible gelatin stuff with water in it, and you pop the whole thing in your mouth and consume the entire thing.
That's disgusting.
That's what he looked like. It was like somewhere between...
Him blobbing out was a solid effect of him finally turning back into a jellyfish and then turning into a puddle of water. I mean, it's a weird, weird transformation conceptually, like... Yes, we are 70% water or whatever, but seemed like at the end he was 100% water.
Yeah, and then later they're like, are you sure you saw what you thought you saw?
Yeah,
and
that also like, kind of seemed like set up for like feel maybe...
feel like the answer is yes.
Yeah, he definitely, Jellyfish Man, 100% does not make a return. And their science seemed to suggest that he was on a terminal path there, that it was not like, you know, an aspect of his mutant powers. So Magneto's whole plan... which is stupid, is to transfer his powers to Rogue, which somehow transferring his power, enough of his power to Rogue for her to power his mutant creation machine.
Which will kill her.
Will kill her, but it won't kill him. I'm not sure how that math works out. It seems like for her to have enough of his power to do it, he would have to die transferring it to her. So... I don't know. It doesn't make a ton of sense because it's not real, but it's still stupid.
He comes back in X-Men 2.
Who, Blob Man?
Well, the actor,
no,
the character.
No, because as you saw at
the
end,
as with Mystique being
Mystique takes his place because no one knows that he turned into a blob.
Yeah, but I thought that the actor and the character had more of an arc than just that first movie.
Even though her shape-shifting... is so convincing throughout, except for the numerous times where she doesn't change the color of her eyes.
No. They just flash in a way like, here I am.
There's that, but also
when
she shapeshifted into the... I mean, of course it's for us.
Yeah.
But like when she shapeshifted into the
Statue of Liberty,
she also opens her eyes and it's like, I get
it. It's like her Where's Waldo moment, where you're like, oh, I see her.
I get it. I mean, on this too, this is fun because I'm the audience.
So
it says I read that there was a Stan Lee cameo.
Yeah, he's the hot dog vendor on the beach.
Oh right, okay. Mm-hmm. I forgot.
I learned it from IMDb. I didn't catch it in the moment.
Yeah, me neither. Now that you say that, I thought the hot dog
vendor.
I
didn't have to come clean, but I did.
Because I remember there being a hot dog stand that's like right where
he
steals...
But you were distracted by the blob man being a nude adult man on a beach full of children without there being any kind of outcry or intervention. And then he steals clothing.
Distracted by this young boy seeing Jellyfish Man's hog and by the TV on the beach.
Yeah, there's a TV on the hot dog stand.
And
on the beach.
And then by
just your typical beach.
Jellyfish Man finding clothes right by the TV.
Like, every single thing about it was normal.
Yes, everything about that was enough to make... And also, it's not like Stan Lee had a line where he says something Stan Lee-ish.
No, so, not this time.
We're still in the nascent phase of Stan Lee being in these movies.
What's his character's name? The Observer?
Oh, Uatu the Watcher?
Uatu the Watcher.
I mean, it's... up for debate whether that's who he is, but it is.
He said so. Stan Lee said
really?
So.
Oh, really? He revealed that?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, okay. That's cool.
It's on the record.
I like it.
Yeah.
The
X-Men saved the day. I don't know why we need to go into detail about the rest of it. It was too silly. Is there anything worth talking about in the rest of that winding down?
While Rogue is powering the machine, it turns a streak of her hair white, which is iconic element of her character design.
We did talk about hair a lot.
Only tie to the traditional depiction of Rogue that she will have beside the life-sucking.
And Southern accent, right?
I guess.
I don't know.
I mean, yeah, she's supposed to have a Southern accent, but she's supposed to sound like hella Southern and, you know, like, oh, I don't even know.
Is she supposed to say, like, y'all a lot?
Y'all, shug, you know.
Okay.
The sort of things a cartoon Southern person would say.
Okay. Anyway, the day is saved.
The day is saved.
Magneto goes to a Lucite jail.
Yeah. Oh, that was a funny thing in the research is that neither Ian McKellen nor Patrick Stewart knew how to play chess before this movie and had to be taught how for this scene.
That's rad.
It's kind of funny.
A couple of sirs.
Yeah.
These playing some Lucite chess.
Very prestigious British actors. I mean, I don't know how to play chess.
I do.
Cool.
Thanks.
If you're ever in a Lucite prison, you'll have to teach me so we have something to do.
I mean, you'll have to visit for that to happen.
I will, but only when I need to say something ominous to make you think about the crimes you've done.
Don't come. So Rogue decides that she's going to stay at Mutant High School, and Logan gets the information he needs to set the story for X-Men 2 in motion, which is that there's an abandoned military base in Canada not too far from where the X-Men found him, and probably that's where he got his origin story.
Yeah, for being on the road for 15 years, he sure didn't make much progress.
Well, I mean, he wasn't actively on the road, right? He was probably just like moving around from place to place aimlessly without any sense of self.
I guess, but I mean, if that's the kind of place he's in, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of places to choose from.
Oh my gosh. This I enjoyed watching this movie today, and that is because a lot of time has passed and I have seen a lot of other movies since then, but now that we're really ripping into it, I totally remember why I didn't like it when I saw it in 2000.
It's not great. It's not terrible. This is probably the first time I've seen it in like 10 years. I think of the movies we're going to be going through before we get to the Marvel Cinematic Universe era, I think X-Men 2 and the first two Spider-Man movies are the only ones I've seen multiple times. I don't think any of the other ones really warranted it to me.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
Would you like to know some of the people who were considered to play Rogue?
I would.
Kirsten Dunst.
Okay, I see that.
Sarah Michelle Gellar.
Oh.
Christina Ricci.
Hmm.
Rachel Lee Cook.
Okay.
And Natalie Portman. Natalie Portman turned it down.
Well, wouldn't this have been
during Star Wars time?
During the
time
that she was playing Queen Amidala.
Yes.
And it was while Sarah Michelle Gellar was still playing Buffy.
Yes.
Who else is on that list again?
Christina Ricci, Rachel Lee Cook, Kirsten Dunst.
Kirsten Dunst. I could totally see her doing this. I don't know. Who would I like in this role?
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like, if it was like Rogue from the cartoon / comics, then Sarah Michelle Gellar would be, like, I mean, any of them would be cool and better, and that character would be cooler, but also very, very different.
Maybe I'm thinking of Jubilee when I think of what Rogue looks like in the comics.
Jubilee has a bright yellow jacket and pink sunglasses and big hoop earrings and short black hair.
Okay.
And she shoots fireworks from her hands.
No, this is who I'm thinking
of. Yeah, that's Rogue.
Okay, Rogue from the cartoons, because yeah, I think Ellen Page would have been better. Like, I could see Ellen Page as the cartoon version of Rogue.
I don't know.
Or Bonnie Raitt.
I mean,
is Bonnie Raitt.
Right. I mean, yeah, like, the aesthetics of that cartoon are very much that era. And it's kind of a bummer that like, that's the thing that kind of bothered me about X-Men movies in general, is they're so reluctant to touch on, like, so eager to take characterization and plot elements for a lot of the characters from the cartoons. Like, it's obvious that's where, like, Bryan Singer's most of his familiarity with the series comes from, but then not take any of the visual stuff when all of that is, like, the most iconic stuff. Then at the end of X-Men Apocalypse, they're like, oh, check it out. We're all wearing the original blue and yellow X-Men uniforms, even though none of us are probably ever coming back to do any of these movies ever again.
That movie was not good.
It was not good, and it was the worst, least opportune time to throw in that fan service.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like Days of Future Past.
It was, yeah.
It's going to be a really long time till we get to that.
Yeah, like, we have...
Don't say.
Some depths to plumb.
Well, you keep telling me that, and then I keep, like, resetting my memory about it. So, I'm on board. Let's do it.
See you next time.
All right.